I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the G8 focuses on the Syria conflict. The UN appeals for funding to help Syrian refugees.
We fear that we may not be able to continue the operations unless funding comes urgently. We are at a breaking point.
Egypt's Christians look ahead after religious violence. And Amnesty International calls executions in the Middle East alarming. It's all ahead. Syria tops the agenda as G8 foreign ministers gather for talks today in London. Britain and France are expected to continue their push to lift a European Union arms embargo and allow shipments of weapons to rebels opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Some EU members worry that a flood of weapons would only worsen the Syrian crisis. Syrian opposition officials are also in London and are due to hold talks on the sidelines of the meeting with some of the ministers, including British Foreign Secretary William Hague and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Mr. Kerry told reporters Tuesday the talks will focus on how to get Syria's president to accept the reality of his situation.
So we are left with no choice but to try to find ways to get him to think differently about what lies in the future. That will be part of the discussion in London and in the ensuing weeks.
The group of eight links the United States, Britain, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, Canada, and Russia. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is urging officials in Damascus to allow a wider UN probe into allegations of the use of chemical weapons by both sides in the Syrian conflict.
I appeal to the government of Syria to extend its fullest cooperation and to allow the investigation to proceed. The mission is ready. They are ready to deploy. They are waiting in Cyprus. I sincerely hope that the government of Syria will accept the modalities that I have proposed for the mission.
Syria wanted an investigation into the alleged use of chemical weapons by rebels in Aleppo, but it rejected Mr. Bond's decision that the probe also should include allegations of the use of chemical weapons by government forces in Homs. Al-Qaeda in Iraq says it is united with a Syrian jihadist group fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad. An audio message from Al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, posted on Islamist websites Tuesday, says his group has been funding cells from Syria's al-Nusra Front. The combined groups, the message says, will be called the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. The al-Nusra Front achieved prominence early last year when it claimed responsibility for several powerful bombings in the Syrian capital and the northern city of Aleppo. The link between al-Nusra and al-Qaeda had been suspected, leading the United States in December to designate the al-Nusra Front a terrorist group. We asked Aaron Zellin with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy for his reaction to the merging of the two groups.
The announcement from al-Qaeda in Iraq essentially highlights that al-Qaeda itself feels that they're in a comfortable enough position in Syria to essentially formalize publicly what the United States already announced in its designation of Jabhat al-Nusra, that, in fact, Jabhat al-Nusra was established by al-Qaeda in Iraq and that it's an arm of al-Qaeda and that this was all planned by Ayman al-Zawahiri, by al-Qaeda in Pakistan, actually. And today, you actually heard a video message from the leader of Jabhat al-Nusra in response, and he himself officially pledged bayat or fealty to Ayman al-Zawahiri. So it suggests that this was all planned out ahead of time.
You use the word comfortable, that al-Qaeda feels comfortable in Syria. What do you mean by that?
Well, in terms of Jabhat al-Nusra themselves have been involved in a lot of governance activities in the northern and eastern parts of the country going back to about November and December in response to the failings of some factions in the Free Syrian Army who were looting and extorting people in terms of bread and fuel. And Jabhat al-Nusra, as well as some other Salafi factions, have been in control of these things since, and they've been seen as doing it in a fair manner and also providing these services in a below-market price. And as a result, people have been appreciative of this, and therefore they're seen as a good force within the rebellion. And one of the concerns that al-Qaeda originally had, which is why they didn't just call it like al-Qaeda in Syria, was because of the stigma of its name, as well as the fact that they wanted people to get to know Jabhat al-Nusra for who they were themselves and not just basing it off of what they perceived as potential media distortions.
And you think this might backfire on them?
It's definitely possible that it could backfire, since some might view this now as an imposition from the outside. Additionally, while people are definitely appreciative of these services that they're doing, there's been small backlash against some of the social issues that they're trying to push in terms of banning alcohol or forcing women to wear the niqab or full veil, as well as some other issues. But this is still not that large scale. And if they continue to be fair arbiters in the way that they provide basic needs, I don't see this as being an issue in the short term, but it potentially could portend to more issues in the medium to long term.
And those would be?
Potential backlash and them being marginalized or pushed to the side and other factions becoming more popular, potentially the Syrian Islamic Front, which is a more mainstream Salafi faction in the rebellion.
You believe Washington should take some action?
Yeah, I think that the United States should be helping out more in terms of trying to contain the outgrowth of a group like Jabhat al-Nusra. Of course, the United States wants the fall of Bashar al-Assad, but they don't want that him to fall whenever that happens, and then it to be replaced by a bunch of individuals that are aligned with al-Qaeda, and instead, you know, individuals who are more, you know, willing to play the game of democracy, or at least be willing to create some level of stability and not have an anti-American or Western appeal.
Aaron Zellin, the Richard Borrow Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The UN Refugee Agency reports that more than 1.3 million Syrian refugees have now fled to neighboring countries. The UNHCR warns this number could triple by the end of the year if a political solution to the conflict in Syria is not found. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the deteriorating situation inside Syria is causing an average of 8,000 people a day to flee into neighboring countries in fear of their lives. The agency's Syria Regional Refugee Coordinator, Panos Mumsis, says this massive outflow of people has boosted the number of refugees registered in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, and Iraq to 1.3 million. He notes this figure does not take into account those people who have not registered, so the actual number of refugees in these countries is much higher.
This is a significant increase if you think that today, 1 year ago, 12 months ago, the actual figure was 30,000. So in 12 months, we have gone from 30,000 Syrian refugees to 1,300,000. The 1,300,000 represents 120% of the planning assumption figure we had taken and hoped, thought would reach by June 2013. We had planned to help 1,100,000 by June, and we already are at 1,300,000. Three quarters of the refugees who have fled continue to be women and children.
While the number of refugees continues to increase, the money available to assist them is not. The UNHCR says it only has received one-third of the $1 billion it needs to care for the Syrian refugees until June. Despite the lack of cash, Mumsis says UN aid agencies have been scaling up assistance since January. He says they have expanded staff, health services, food, water, sanitation, shelter, and educational programs.
While we have put in place relief services and relief operations on a 24/7 basis, we have relief workers going to work at night as well as the day because the refugees cross the borders every day. We fear that we may not be able to continue the operations unless funding comes urgently. We are at a breaking point.
Mumsa says UN aid agencies already have cut life-saving services to the bone, and he does not know how much is left to cut. He notes that the refugee camps are overcrowded and new camps have to be built. Of the $1.5 billion pledged at a conference in Kuwait earlier this year, he says only $400 million has been received. He says the traditional Western donors have honored their pledges, but the United Nations is still waiting for the $1 billion pledged by the Gulf Arab states. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry wrapped up a three-day visit to Israel and the Palestinian territories Tuesday, during which he expressed hope for an eventual Middle East peace agreement. After a two-hour meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the U.S. official said he is intent on reviving the stalled Middle East peace talks, and Mr. Netanyahu said he was committed to the same goal.
I'm determined to not only to resume the peace process with the Palestinians, but to make a serious effort to end this conflict once and for all.
The peace talks have been stalled for nearly 3 years. The Palestinians say before they will return to the negotiating table, Israel must halt construction of Jewish settlements in the West Bank and release political prisoners. The Israelis say they are prepared to return to the talks, but without free conditions. Secretary Kerry's Mideast diplomacy tour came on the heels of a previous visit to the region by himself and President Obama. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Ori Neer with the organization Americans for Peace Now about the president's intentions with that trip.
What I think the president wanted to do, and I think he achieved it, is other than doing a listening tour, which he did, is also plant some seeds with Israeli public, to generate support for peace. But at the very least, if there isn't immediate support for a U.S.-led initiative, at least to sort of shake people up in Israel, to wake them up a little bit, to shake them out of their indifference that the Israeli public has adopted in recent years in terms of Israeli-Palestinian peace. And I think that although there isn't a major shift in Israel, a major wave of support for a U.S.-led peace initiative, at the very least there is a renewed recognition that things are not as they should be, that the occupation is not normal, and that there should be some change. So that, I think, the president has achieved in his historic speech in Jerusalem.
But the new Israeli cabinet formation seems to give Settlers' Party Jewish Home key ministries, including housing. How could that help peace talks, which were abandoned because of the continued settlement activities?
It doesn't help peace talks, obviously. The issue is, however, that you have an Israeli coalition now, a ruling coalition, that, yes, does include the settler party, which is the Jewish Home. It's very much a settler party. But it also includes a larger party, Yesh Atid, led by Yair Lapid, which is a sort of, I would say, middle-class, moderate, pragmatic party that includes many people who are very much supporters of peace, supporters of a two-state solution, people who've been involved in the past in initiatives to end the occupation, and who are agitating in that direction. So it's a kind of a yin and yang situation where you have both, and while both parties have indicated that Israeli-Palestinian peace is not on the top of their agenda, it is something that Yesh Atid very much wants to promote, and one can only hope that Lapid will use his very senior position in the Israeli government to create perhaps a sort of an alliance with President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry to help them in their, at least what seems to be at the moment, initiative to restart a peace plan.
Ori Neer, spokesman for Americans for Peace Now, says any solution to the Mideast peace problem has to be negotiated by Israelis and Palestinians and cannot be dictated by the United States. You're tuned to the Voice of America, broadcasting to you from Washington. We invite you to stop by our two websites, voanews.com and MiddleEastVoices.com, for the latest world news. The latest spasm of religious violence in Egypt is raising some concern about the fate of the approximately 8 million Christians in the Islamist-led nation. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has details from Cairo.
A few months ago, Cairo's St. Mark's Cathedral was a place of joy as Christians welcomed a new Coptic pope. Now the streets outside the main Coptic church in Egypt are scattered with rubble, the remains of deadly fighting between those in the church and angry Muslims outside. This latest bout of religious violence has prompted some Christians to consider the relative calm of the past, before the revolution and the rise of Islamist politicians.
ما مرش علينا الحاجات دي ابدا ولا عمرنا شفنا ان البلد توصل للشكل ده.
A Coptic man near the cathedral grounds says this type of thing has never happened before, nor has the country ever reached this state of affairs. It will hurt not only Christians and Muslims, but the nation as a whole. This is wrong, he says. We are one people and one country. Analysts say a tradition of tolerance is eroding as security diminishes, the economy tumbles, and conservative strains of Islam gain strength. Yusuf Sidhom, editor of the weekly Watani newspaper, is an advocate for Coptic rights.
This war is very much not only the Christians of Egypt, but also a good percentage of the Muslims of Egypt, whom I describe as moderate Muslims.
Political analyst Hisham Qasim says many Egyptians are beginning to take a stand.
There's more frustration with extremism. People are beginning to see how unnecessary it is, okay? That it does not improve their life in any way. In fact, takes it to the opposite direction. But right now, there is only one solution on the short term, which is the firm application of law.
Many feel the government has failed to do just that. Coptic Pope Tawadros criticized President Mohamed Morsi Tuesday for favoring promises over action. Editor Sidhom says the fear that the government cannot or will not protect Christians has prompted some to consider drastic action of their own.
Of course, we meet people every day, especially Christians, who express their worries and concerns and their insecurity about tomorrow. And they do not hide their desire to leave Egypt if they can.
Hisham Qasim says such thoughts recall the flight of another religious minority in the 1950s and 60s.
Right now there's a movie played in Cairo cinemas called On the Jews of Egypt. And it's about the Jews who were forced to leave. And there is that fear now. People just don't want the day to come when there's a movie called On the Christians of Egypt.
Numbers may be on the Christian side. In a country with some 8 million Christians, analysts say Egypt has no choice but to confront the problem and find a remedy. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
One nations carried out the death penalty in 2012, according to Amnesty International's yearly report published today. That is the same number as in 2011, but a marked shift from 10 years ago when 28 countries carried out executions. In London, Selah Hennessy reports.
Kamil Albashoka is an Iranian Arab who sought asylum in Britain 7 years ago. Two of his cousins and his three best friends, all from the Awazi Arab minority, are accused of treason and are facing execution. The activists say they're not guilty and have experienced ill treatment in prison. He told VOA, had he not left Iran, he may have faced the same fate.
Definitely, if I didn't flee, I would execute probably with them in the same situation. Just how I was lucky to flee.
Now, when he's not studying, he campaigns with the support of global human rights organizations to stop the executions of his friends and family.
I was very close with them, so we had a very good time with each other. We tried our best to help our people. So I cannot imagine if they execute. I can't. It's so hard.
The London-based human rights group Amnesty International monitors executions. It says the number of executions last year in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East was alarming. Jen Wetzel is the author of Amnesty's 2012 report.
75% of all confirmed executions that we are counting were carried out in three countries worldwide, which is Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia.
And especially in Iraq and Iran, we see hundreds of executions. They're just executions we know about, but we do see hundreds of executions every year.
He says 70% of executions in Iran are related to drugs charges. According to the report, 682 executions were recorded worldwide last year, two more than in 2011. Methods included lethal injection, hanging, beheading, and firing squads. Amnesty says aside from Iran, Saudi Arabia and Iraq, China and the United States were the worst offenders. The United States was the only country in the Americas to carry out executions. The number was 43, which is the same as in 2011. In April, Connecticut became the 17th state to abolish the death penalty. Although China's figures are a state secret, Amnesty believes thousands are executed there every year. Wetzel says the report highlights some bad news in the Asia-Pacific region, the resumption of executions last year in Japan, India, and Pakistan. But he says there was also good news.
On the positive front, we do see a lot of movement, specifically in West Africa, where the governments in Benin, in Ghana, in Sierra Leone are actively taking steps to move away from the death penalty and are actually preparing legal abolition.
Despite those moves in West Africa, the number of death sentences across sub-Saharan Africa rose in 2012 because of higher tallies in Sudan and the Gambia. In Gambia, 9 people were killed in August, a major shift after a 30-year hiatus. Saleh Hennessy for VOA News, London.
A prominent Islamic scholar says the war on terror focuses too much on religious extremists and not enough on the problem of weak central governments failing to serve rural populations. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns reports on a new, thought-provoking study that ranges from Pakistan and the Philippines to Mali and Nigeria.
French troops fighting al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists in Mali have helped restore order to areas overrun by an ethnic Tuareg rebellion. But local leaders such as Moussa Agometa say solving the crisis means improving the quality of rural life.
What brought on all these problems is poverty and the lack of development in the north.
That's a challenge as the international community faces new threats in Africa, says French President François Hollande.
L'instabilité du Sahel.
In the instability in the Sahel, there is a risk that all unresolved conflicts can fuel terrorism. We need to work more urgently to resolve the suffering of the population over 30 years.
In his widely discussed book, The Thistle and the Drone, Islamic scholar Akbar Ahmed examines the fight against terrorism from Afghanistan and Pakistan to Yemen and Somalia, from the southern Philippines to Mali and Nigeria.
All of them reflect larger tribal groups which have problems with the central government. All of them reflect areas where there are serious economic problems in terms of their natural resources. And all of them suggest that we are still misreading the relationship that they have with Islam.
In Nigeria's fight against Boko Haram militants, Ahmed says the government is focusing on Islamic fundamentalism to distract attention from its failures in development.
Framing it in a different way, the central government is able then to draw in the United States and Europe, with the result that it does become a kind of jihad, a kind of crusades, a kind of confrontation between the West, Christianity, and Islam.
Ahmed says central governments too often make enemies of whole ethnic groups.
And when that happens, from, say, 100 or 500 or 5,000 criminally inclined individuals, you are then including 5 or 10 or 15 million people of the tribe. And that is a disaster. It's a disaster for the nation.
And the international community.
Just when Afghanistan seems to be dying down, when Pakistan seems to be moving along the path of democracy and another election coming up in the country, you have now the United States and Europe being sucked into another war on terror, and that whole cycle seems to be starting again in the Sahel.
Ahmed says breaking the cycle means rethinking the war on terror.
If the problem is stemming from tribal culture and codes and customs, then surely the solution also lies in them, not in religion and looking at the verses of the Quran. And I think in that sense, the scholars of the war on terror over the last decade have been looking at the wrong thing.
Ahmed recommends efforts to resolve tensions between weak central governments in former colonies and minority ethnic groups at their peripheries. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.